Now today we have got a very stark question set for our panel, and that is Iran and the West, is war inevitable? And as I listened to the news this morning and I heard of the ships sailing up through the Straits of Hormuz, I thought that this was very much a question of the moment. We have a very distinguished panel. I'm going to introduce them all now and then call them to speak, because I think it's easier to do it that way. Malcolm Rifkin. So Malcolm Rifkin really needs no introduction. Former Foreign Secretary, MP for Kensington and Chelsea, and now for Kensington, and is also the chairman of the Intelligence and Security Committee, although he makes it clear that he's not here in that capacity today, which I'm very relieved about, because I'm also on that committee, and it's nice to think that I can be, I needn't be overawed by him on this occasion. I'm going to ask him to speak first, because he has to leave at 2:15 to go to another meeting. We then have Dr. Arshin Adib Mohallam, who is a reader in Comparative Politics and International Relations at SOAS, the University of London. He received his PhD in early 2004, and after that he lived, lectured and researched extensively in Iran, so he has a good internal working knowledge of that country, and we very much look forward to hearing what he has to say. I will then be calling on Jonathan Fryer, who is on my far right, who is a writer, lecturer and broadcaster on international affairs, focusing particularly on the Middle East, including Iran. He lectures part-time also at SOAS. He freelances mainly for the BBC, The Guardian, The Diplomat, and although he looks far too young, also for the Oldie. He's chairman of the London Liberal Democrats, so he will obviously feel at home in these surroundings. And finally, we've got, again, who probably needs no introduction, Sir Jeremy Greenstock, who was a diplomat. His culminating appointment was as our representative at the United Nations, but then after he retired from that, he was brought back from retirement and went to Iraq as our special envoy between September 2003 and March 2004. After he left the government service, he was the director of the Ditchley Foundation, and now he is an advisor to a number of very important companies. I will call them in that order, but first of all, I'm going to call on Malcolm Rifkin to begin this session.
Michael, thank you very, very much indeed, and my apologies that I have to leave slightly early. I think by the time that we have all resolved the comparatively straightforward problem of Iran, I have to go off to a meeting to discuss whether war between England and Scotland is ultimately inevitable and how that might best be avoided by other means. Let me start my remarks by assuming, at least for the purposes of the meeting today, that Iran really is has embarked on a process of trying to acquire a nuclear weapon. I personally think that is almost unanswerable at this now with the evidence we have. Let us assume that, certainly for the purposes of my own remarks. And I don't make any distinction about whether Iran plans to have a nuclear weapon or stop a few months short of one in order that it can complete that process at a time of its own choosing. Because either way, the destabilizing implications are, for all practical purposes, synonymous. Let us also assume that we would all agree that diplomatic means, and if diplomatic means aren't making progress, economic pressure has to be applied to try to bring Iran to the negotiating table to find a peaceful, non-violent, non-military way of resolving this dilemma. I think certainly everyone would agree that the diplomatic route is essential. Some might dispute the question of economic sanctions, but certainly the question of a military option, if it is an option, must go without saying, is at the very, very end of what still is quite a long process. And nothing that I'm going to say just now implies that that is something that needs to be reaching a decision in the short term for reasons that I hope will not be controversial. So if Iran could, on current evidence, be a nuclear weapon state, if it is not persuaded to desist from that in a relatively short period of time, is that something we just have to learn to live with? Is it just something, well, there have been other nuclear weapon states, so we shouldn't be too alarmed by it? I think there is a qualitative difference here of a very fundamental kind, and that is not only because of the nature of the Iranian regime as such, but because it seeks to have nuclear weapons, partly to enhance its own security, the belief that its potential aggression against it, especially from the United States, would be much less likely in such an event. But it also has an existential dispute with Israel. The almost unheard of statements of a head of state seeking to wipe another state off the face of the map cannot be taken lightly, given the nature of Iranian society. But you know, at the end of the day, my main concern, although these are real issues, is not the implications for Israel. Israel is probably quite able to defend its own fundamental interests, even against an Iran with nuclear weapons. The Israelis are right to be deeply concerned, but actually I think the most dangerous and damaging consequences of an Iranian nuclear weapon would be what is now the likely unprecedented proliferation that would lead to throughout the whole of the Middle East as a whole. And I noticed even in the last 24 hours, Prince Turki of Saudi Arabia, a very senior member of the Saudi royal family, former intelligence chief, former ambassador to this country, has made it clear that Saudi Arabia would have to consider, in the event of Iran, in addition to Israel, having nuclear weapons, Saudi Arabia would have to consider going the same route. And it is well known that the Saudis helped the Pakistanis achieve nuclear weapon status, and it wouldn't take them very long with Pakistani cooperation to themselves become a nuclear weapon state. And if Saudi Arabia and Iran become nuclear weapon states, it has to be at least a significant possibility, perhaps a probability, that at some stage Egypt and Turkey, perhaps others, would also follow the same route. And so we would end up with a situation where the Middle East, already the most combustible part of the world, the most dangerous part of the world, the part of the world where war is most likely to break out for reasons regardless of the West's position, could become also not just a country with a region with nuclear weapons, but a region where virtually every state of significant size and significant military capability had become a nuclear weapon state. And that is, I don't think, an alarmist statement. It has to be a serious probability on the basis of the obvious self-interest of the Arab world and its realization that Iran, apart from its other motives, is also keen to assert itself as the prime power, not just in the Gulf, but also of the Muslim world in the Middle East, through its own belief in its own destiny. So can they be stopped? And let us assume that diplomatic and economic means are not going to work. I still think that economic sanctions could work, but for them to work would require the Arab states to do what they did in the case of Libya and to publicly call for support for action of the Security Council to such a degree that Russia and China couldn't refuse. That happened over Libya. It could potentially happen over Iran. There is no evidence at the moment that that is likely to be the scenario. So is there a military option? Well, let me put it in very careful terms. I think the first question to consider is, would a military option work? There's no point considering a military option if at the end of the day it would not destroy or very seriously degrade Iran's nuclear weapons capability. My own view, and I'm not an expert in the technicalities, but my own view is it is almost impossible to imagine that Israel by itself could deliver such a blow against Iran. They took out the Osirak nuclear reactor of Iraq, but that required one flight, one evening, to a site that was on the surface and could be destroyed in a single attack, and it was a relatively straightforward military operation. As we all know, the Iranians have learned from that experience. They have dispersed their nuclear weapons capability throughout Iran, some of it deep underground, and that has been a means to try to prevent the military option. So my own assumption is that Israel by itself might wish to act for wider reasons, but it could not by itself achieve the desired end. And therefore we would have a massive crisis in the region without even having delivered the result that was intended or desired. That, of course, leaves the United States. And the United States has massive military capability. And no one, not even those who are interested in a military option, are contemplating the use of ground forces or ground attack. This is all about the use of air power. And I would imagine, I can't be certain about this, I don't have that expertise, but I would imagine that the United States, if it was prepared to use the military capability available to it, and if it was prepared to contemplate several nights of sustained bombing, with its bunker-busting bombs, which we know can penetrate deep underground, there must at least be a significant possibility, which President Obama will have no doubt consulted his chiefs of staff on, that if they are willing to use the military capability at their disposal, that they could either destroy or, more likely, severely degrade certainly at Natanz and Qom, where the uranium enrichment is taking place, and push back perhaps a number of years, a good number of years, if not for a very long period of time, the capability of Iran to become a nuclear weapon state. Now, most people do argue and point quite reasonably to the downside of any military action. And they rightly say, well, you could have the Straits of Hormuz closed, you'd have a massive hike in the oil price, the Iranians would retaliate by sending missiles, perhaps against Israel, they would encourage terrorism incidents by Hamas and Hezbollah, they would no doubt have a lot of support on the streets of the Arab world, and their own people in Iran, who are already dissatisfied with the Iranian government, might then turn to support their own government when it was being attacked in this way. I'm going through it very, very quickly, because I don't disagree with any of these assessments. They all seem to be perfectly understandable assessments. But I'm going to make, in the very short period I have left, the one fundamental point, which for me is, I think, the most important consideration. Here we have a situation where all these consequences that would flow from, then let us assume that an American military strike would destroy the Iranian nuclear capability, or so degrade it to push it back 10 years. All the downsides I have referred to are essentially, and forgive the oversimplification, short term. They will last a few days, a few weeks, perhaps a few months. The implications of Iranian nuclear weapon capability are not short term, they are permanent. And so the judgment that would have to be made, if the military advice said that it can be done, the judgment that has to be made, not just by the United States, but by the Middle East, by the Arab world, by the West, by the world as a whole, is it tolerable to accept these short-term, very serious downsides of a hike in the oil price, of a temporary closure of the Straits of Hormuz, a temporary increase in terrorist incidents, and the other impacts on public opinion in Iran and elsewhere? All these would happen, but it's likely, I would suggest, they would last for a few weeks, perhaps a few months. Whereas the consequences of an Iranian nuclear weapon state, and particularly if it led to Saudi Arabia, possibly Egypt, possibly Turkey going the same way, would create a permanent, massive deterioration in the stability of the region and the long-term implications of infinitely greater chaos in the Middle East than the short-term consequences of an American military attack have to be taken into account. That's all I'm going to say because of the time available. I'm not saying I'm recommending that. At this stage, it would be grossly premature to come to any conclusion in any event. And also, I do not have access to the military advice that the President of the United States will undoubtedly be getting. But in the kind of framework that I have described, if it is deliverable, and if my basic assumption is correct, that the advantages would be permanent and the disadvantages temporary, then it seems to me, with a very sober mind, one cannot simply dismiss it out of hand for the reasons that I have suggested. Thank you very much.
We'll try to calm down the discussion a little bit on the basis of the framework that I have, and probably a couple of analytical points, and they really emanate from conversations with people in Washington, people in Iran, and the wider region. I think a straightforward answer to the question whether or not war is inevitable would be no, and as I mentioned, there are several straightforward reasons why I think it is not inevitable. First, I think the Obama administration has a far more realistic approach to world politics. We see a different tone even towards Iran and towards the wider region. The hawks are flushed out of the system. There is no Pentagon that is staffed by people like Rumsfeld and others. There is no Cheney, there is no Wolfowitz, there is no Richard Perle. So I think there is there are different personalities and power, and an understanding also that after the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, military success does not necessarily mean a strategic gain. We shouldn't forget that in Iraq right now, the most powerful external actor is not the United States, but it is Iran, which is, of course, entirely detrimental to the strategic purpose of that war, and certainly also the strategic aims of the United States. And, of course, in Afghanistan, we are still engaged after 10 years The Taliban is very much still a factor in that country, and Iran continues to be a player in Afghanistan as well. I feel that the State Department right now is still in charge. The State Department is not using a discourse that's premised on war. The term war on terror in many ways substituted by other terms such as smart power or soft power, a concept that was conceptualized by Joseph Nye and that really emphasizes coercive diplomacy rather than war. Second, and interrelated, there is an understanding in Washington that an attack on Iran would unleash a protracted regional war. I don't think that the repercussions would be short-term at all. I think there would be long-term, adding not only to the relative anger towards Israel on the Arab street, but adding to that a Persian or Iranian component as well. There seems to be an understanding that a war on Iran would lead to military escalation on the Lebanese border with Israel, of course, because of the still functioning Iran-Hezbollah axis. I think in many ways the Pentagon is taking that into consideration as well. A war would yield a sustained period of asymmetric warfare, probably with global repercussions. It would seriously deteriorate the security situation in Iraq, in Palestine, and in Afghanistan. It would most likely destabilize the staunchest allies of the United States in the Persian Gulf, including Saudi Arabia, which has a restive Shia minority that is demonstrating as we speak on the streets of Saudi Arabia in the eastern oil-rich provinces. Again, I don't think a war would yield stability in Saudi Arabia and indeed in Bahrain, which has a Shia majority that is again demonstrating against the Al-Khalifa monarchy there. And probably most fundamentally, a war in Iran would plunge the world economy into deeper recession. After the $1 trillion US dollar price tag of the Iraq war, I think there is an understanding in the United States that another protected war is simply not financeable. The war would be in many ways a unilateral war. I don't see how NATO can be on board when there will be overt opposition by Turkey, for instance. Turkey is in many ways certainly an economic ally of Iran, and there would be overt opposition towards any kind of NATO involvement from Turkey, and I would assume from members of the European Union as well. Turkey has recently pledged to triple its economic transactions with Iran, which are already at US dollar $10 billion per year. Of course, Turkey is also part of a new strategic configuration in the region. It is not entirely subservient to US demands anymore. It has repositioned itself towards the Palestinian issue, and it has repositioned itself towards the Iranian issue as well, acting as an interlocutor for a diplomatic solution to the nuclear file. We shouldn't forget, of course, that in this country, the Liberal Democrats have in their party manifesto as well a no to a war in Iran. Again, I think politically, and any war really needs a political transmission belt to function. We are living in a democracy, and you know, even selling a war within the context that we are having right now would be politically, I think, very difficult, and certainly in terms of the politics today, it would plunge, I think, the country into a major political crisis. And in the United States itself, of course, there is organized opposition to the war. And even in Israel, I mean, a recent poll by an Israeli institution indicates that only 40% of Israeli Jews support a military strike on Iran, even though 90% of them think that Iran will eventually acquire nuclear weapons. When asked whether it would be better for both Israel and Iran to have the bomb, or for neither to have it, 65% of Israeli Jews said neither, and a remarkable 64% favored the idea of a nuclear-free zone. So even the idea that there is any kind of consensus within Israeli society in favor of war is flawed. In addition, senior Israeli and U.S. officials have said that there is no military solution to the war, including Ehud Barak, Leon Panetta, and a range of current and former security and intelligence officials. So both on the level of government, I believe, and within society, there is concerted, systematic opposition to a war against Iran. And the former CIA chief, Michael Hayden, probably brought it all together when he recently said that, and I quote, "Attacking Iran would guarantee that which we are trying to prevent, an Iran that will spend nothing to build a nuclear weapon and that would build it in secret. So again, both on the level of government and society, I don't see the movement towards a military solution. I don't see this political transmission belt that would deliver a war. And we know how difficult it was in the build-up to both the war in Afghanistan, certainly in the build-up to the war in Iraq, and we are still dealing with the legal issues, I should re-emphasize as well. So this must lead any rational, disinterested analysis to the conclusion that war is not inevitable or even likely in the short or middle term. And then the next logical step must be, and that's the last point that I would like to make a permanent case for dialogue and reconciliation. This, if anything, would make the prospect of a code peace between Iran and the United States politically viable. And I think that we should spend our intellectual acumen and our political capital to that end. Thank you very much.
I'm now going to call Jonathan Fryer.
Thank you very much indeed, Michael, and good afternoon, everyone. Before I address the specific issue of Iran, I'd like to make a brief, but I hope pertinent, comment about war. Sometimes there are justifiable wars. In modern times, I would cite, for example, the coalition against Iraq after the occupation of Kuwait. And indeed, the operation in the framework of responsibility to protect in Libya when it was obvious that Gaddafi and his son were determined to use the worst possible means to suppress the uprising. However, they, in a sense, are the exceptions. Usually war is not the answer, and people who think war is the answer are frankly asking the wrong question. Now let's turn to Iran. And I'd like to consider briefly some of the main players, beginning quite rightly with Iran itself. There has been a depressing tendency in this country, other member states of the European Union, and indeed the United States, to demonize Iran, the country, and not to recognize the difference between some members of the senior leadership, who we may have well good reason to disapprove of, and a country which has one of the richest histories and cultures in the entire Middle East. We are not talking about some small, insignificant player. And I understand completely why, in recent years, even those Iranians who do not support the current situation are proud to be Iranian and proud that Iran is asserting itself in the Middle East. The second thing is the relationship between Iran and the UK. I'm afraid the history of our bilateral relations does not reflect well on Britain. Even during the colonial era, when Britain interfered dramatically, made sure it got control of the oil resources, and then, of course, notoriously in the 1950s, by getting rid of Mossadegh and acting with the United States and other parties. So it is not surprising that, frankly, Britain is not the flavour of the month in Iran, never has been, and certainly, at the moment, is doing everything possible to make it worse. I do not justify the recent occupation, violent occupation, of the British Embassy in Tehran. Who would? And indeed, even the Iranian Foreign Ministry apologized. It was a curious example of mixed messages coming out of Tehran. But we have to recognize that Britain has a very difficult standing in Iran, even more so because the United States has not been present there for quite a long time. And so, in a sense, we are in the front line. And what are the messages we are giving? A few hours ago, earlier today, or maybe it was tomorrow, as he's in Australia, William Hague made comments that we needed to ratchet up the pressure if we were going to get results. Now, that might seem logical until we analyse the consequences of ratcheting up the pressure. Malcolm Rifkind referred very briefly to some of those possible consequences, not least of which would be actually bringing behind the government and behind Ahmadinejad a large proportion of the Iranian population who currently maybe don't approve of him so much. And then there is the issue of the United States, and what is the United States going to do? I agree with earlier comments that actually President Obama has been far more realistic and I hope better advised than many of his predecessors. But we are in an election year, as I'm sure you have all noticed, and there are some pretty, yes, extreme people in the opposite party. And I fear that the possibility of war against Iran is going to become a sort of masculinity test in the American elections. And that would be a very dangerous development indeed. Now, as Malcolm said, if Iran does develop nuclear weapons, and I share his belief that despite their public denials, they probably do have that in mind, then this will have a knock-on effect. But let's remember, this is not happening in isolation. Let us put ourselves not in the David Lloyd George room in London, but in Tehran, and see the world from Tehran. Iran is surrounded, they feel surrounded by US troops and other armed forces, not only in Afghanistan, and indeed until recent spats, strong American presence in Pakistan, but just over the other narrow strait of the Persian Gulf, American bases in both Bahrain, the Navy base, Air Force base in Qatar. And there is a real fear of being surrounded. And we may too often easily think of Iran as a threat, and I don't underestimate the elements of threat, but let's not forget that they feel threatened and have good reason to feel threatened. Because, of course, I'm sure they understand themselves, if they do indeed have their aspiration fulfilled and get a bomb, then yes, the Saudis are rich enough to, pardon the metaphor, buy one at Harrods, and basically we will see the sort of nuclear proliferation that we would like to avoid. So what instead? Of course, negotiations have to take place. And I fear that the line that the current British government is following is not helping by actually ratcheting up pressure. I don't think that is the right way to be behaving at the moment, frankly. I think it will make things worse. I think it is almost goading the Iranians to close the Strait of Hormuz, to do a macho demonstration of Iranian power, and therefore invite retaliation from outside. And I think that would be absolutely disastrous. I'll end with a cliche, and I'm sorry about that. It's a statement or a saying that I'm sure everyone in the room knows. Churchill said, "Jor-jor is better than war-war." And in this particular situation, he, as often, is absolutely right.
You've heard a variety of views so far, and you're going to hear another shade of view. War is a serious possibility in the Gulf over Iran, but it's not inevitable, nor should it be inevitable. I too make the assumption that Iran is seeking nuclear weapons capability, and we all have to work on that basis until it's clearly proved to the contrary, although, of course, were caught by the consequences of the Iraq intelligence debacle, that this time there has to be proof for Western governments that Iran is seeking nuclear weapons capability before we can use that as a clear reason for something like military action. I start from the premise that the binary choice between proliferation and war has, if possible, to be avoided, because both of those have such disastrous consequences. And I've long been an advocate of diplomacy over Iran, but I believe we've made a mistake, we in the West, in the countries that have been involved in discussions with Iraq, in directing our diplomacy to the nuclear issue in isolation. That has been a mistake and has given Iraq advantages on top of the advantages that have come out of the mistakes that we've made or the poor consequences that have happened from our actions in Iraq and Afghanistan. It shouldn't be diplomacy on the nuclear issue in isolation, because that does not address the whole set of issues that are involved in Iran wanting nuclear weapons, over which Jonathan and one or two of the previous speakers have gone over. Iran does have its own legitimate reasons for considering its strategy in the region: status, vulnerability, its relationships with its neighbours. But the question is too seldom asked, or has been left in the academic and the think tank sphere, of what would form a long-term comprehensive security structure for the Gulf region. I'll come back to that, because I want to look at the case against the use of force, which again my colleagues have gone over to some extent, and which has to be seen in the light of our experience in the use of military action in the region over the last 20 years. But the tensions around that binary choice are well illustrated, I think, if we think of Israel's position, by the proposition that Israel, and indeed many others, think that Israel has the most to lose from not striking Iran. And it's also the case that most observers think that Israel has the most to lose from a strike against Iran. Both those things can be true, and both those things might well be true, but they can't both be the result of actions that are taken. They're mutually exclusive. Military action, in my view, would not destroy Iran's potential to develop nuclear weapons in the long term, and will make it more determined to do so. But aside from that, I take the view that the happening of the Arab Spring last year and other political developments in the region mean that the inflaming of Islamic opinion over an attack on Iran will take on a different character from what might have been the case 2 years ago. That there is the chance of what one could call a perfect storm of Arab opinion coming together with sympathy for Iran over a strike to make Iran the major champion of the Islamic world, and indeed the Arab world, in terms of the Arab street, against Israel over Palestine. And that is not a short-term result of a strike on Iran in current circumstances. It would have ramifications over the whole of the future of Middle East politics, because things would move on from there, and I think would go against Israel's long-term interests. In saying that there needs to be a comprehensive solution in the longer term for a Gulf security structure, I believe that Iran does have legitimate interests and might well be prepared to get into a conversation which would involve some elements of bargaining, of course, over its nuclear status, but which would settle a lot of questions for Iran as well as its neighbours over the longer term, and might be the basis for promoting a region, the Middle East region, as a region without nuclear weapons. And just expressing the problem in those terms immediately helps, as against expressing our attitude to Iran as being aggressive over their apparent intention to develop nuclear weapons. There was a credible story, for instance, in 2002 that Iran came to the United States and said, "Can we talk about Iraq before you do anything? Because I think we have a mutuality of interest in certain areas to do with Iraq." And that, of course, was turned down. And yet it was a sign that Iran, the same regime as is there now, had an interest in the long-term and peaceful future of its own region. As for sanctions, I actually believe that they have to be part of it. Iran has to understand, and it would be part of the bargain, that there is a penalty for lying, there is a penalty for cheating on the NPT, there is a penalty for proliferating, and sanctions must be part of that penalty, and the threat of military action may have to be part of that penalty, but they are different things, sanctions and the threat of force. But sanctions should not be on the table except as a part of a wider conversation about Gulf security. And the kind of discussion which Turkey and Brazil got into a year or more ago, although it was inadequate at the time, memories of Kofi Annan trying to deal with Saddam Hussein before the moment of war, although they got some things wrong, the involvement of other countries than the six involved in diplomacy at the moment would not be an unwise thing in current circumstances. Yes, missed opportunities in the past have made it more difficult. Iran makes diplomacy unpleasant, particularly in the early stages of traded insults, but it doesn't make it any less wise a proposition. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to open it to the floor, but as Malcolm has to go, I want myself to put one point to him for his reaction. I think two of our speakers have spoken about the idea of a nuclear-free Middle East, and Turki Al-Faisal, I think, two or three days ago, suggested that this was an option which should be pursued, which would, of course, include the persuading of Israel to give up its nuclear weapons. Do you, Malcolm, think that is a realistic option at any stage?
I don't think it's a realistic option in the current context. It's obviously highly desirable as an objective. It's worth bearing in mind that when Israel, we all know Israel has nuclear weapons, although they've never admitted to them, the fact that Israel has had them for so many years has never until now led the Saudis or others to say, if Israel has them, we will have to have them as well, because they were not seen as being likely to be used in an aggressive way. So the reaction of the Arab states to Iran is quite different. I don't think it's in fact politically possible for the Israelis to contemplate giving up their nuclear weapons except in the context of a two-state solution successfully being negotiated. And I think my concern is it gives an unjustified alibi to the Iranians to avoid responding to the wishes of the international community to say, well, until the Israelis move, why should we move? That seems to me a very convenient excuse for them breaching their commitments to the Non-Proliferation Treaty.